Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
People of Galway, you're keen. You're very keen. We've given this one mention and the tickets are pretty much already gone. So this may well be the final mention we'll give this. Off the Ball Roadshow, we're going to Galway for the Hurling Final Special Thursday, August 31st, with thanks to Bord Gáis Energy. You can join the Off the Ball team along with a host of hurling legends. We're going to be at the Radisson Blue Hotel looking ahead to Galway Waterford. Tickets are free. Pretty much gone. We mentioned this at 7 o'clock. They're pretty much gone. If you want the last of them, go to newstalk.com/OTB Galway. So go to newstalk.com/OTB Galway to get yours now. So that's the Off the Ball Roadshow live from Galway, 31st of August, thanks to Bord Gáis Energy, hashtag hurling to the core. So earlier on this afternoon, I caught up with John Muldoon, a legend in Galway, obviously, in Irish rugby in Connacht parts. He's played over 300 times for the province, the first Irish player to reach that landmark. It was a thing, really, for a long time when a player managed to get to 200 appearances. Muldoon, who's been going there for a long, long time, age 34, has passed the 300 appearance mark last season. And we started chatting. Obviously, it's exciting times in Galway building up to the final. And I know that John Muldoon, I was saying to him, had played minor hurling for Galway and, in fact, was on a team with lots of players who went on to play senior level who won the All-Ireland Minor back in 2000 and beat a Cork team. And so I was wondering if that was still a day he looks back on often or with much fondness at this stage.
I'm smiling away here to myself. Obviously, growing up and in the, I suppose, the area and location that I was from, hurling was huge. You grew up with a hurl in your hand. You went to school with a hurl in your hand. We went up to our local school pitch. To many, a local school pitch wouldn't mean much, but when there's hazes and cannons and all sorts up there, it gets quite competitive, and it gets the evenings can be quite long during the summer. So we used to have a great time when we were kids up there, from the age of probably 7-8 years of age all the way up to 16-17 years of age. By the time the minors came about, there was four of us from Portumna on it. We just won the minor the year before. We went on to win we just won two back-to-back minors. So we were coming from, I suppose, a good club team, and it was enjoyable to be part of something that was obviously meant a lot to us. In the area, meant a lot to the people around us, and more importantly, meant a lot to us being there representing Galway, and to have four of our club representing our club was huge. After coming back with back-to-back minors, it meant quite a lot to us. And obviously Damien's older brother Keith had passed away not too long before that as well, so nice. Minor had been a big time in our lives, and obviously to be a county minor, to get up to September and to be involved was huge. And to be honest, I know Galway played in the final afterwards. I couldn't tell you one thing that happened in the match after our game. I know they lost. That was about it.
Yeah.
But we had a great day. It was a phenomenal sporting event and occasion to be at. It was something that I still finally look back on, and it's something that I suppose is engraved in you as an Irish person, and as I said, the area that I'm from. I was immensely proud of it, but it was also not a bittersweet moment, but I knew deep down that that was probably going to be one of the last games of hurling I'd ever play or be involved in, because I think we'd one or two more minor games to finish up, and that was the last time I really played, I think, played seriously anyways. I might have went out for an odd junior game in later years, but that was kind of it. I knew Robbie was going to take over, and I knew that that's the path I wanted to go down. Whether I was good enough to do it was another thing, but I had decided that that was kind of one of the last days I would. And I was, I suppose, the most nervous thing for a 17-year-old is to tell all his mates that he wasn't going playing anymore, that he wanted to play rugby.
But yeah, that would certainly add a degree of poignancy to the thing, even as it's unfolding, if that's in the back of your mind. So Damien Hayes on that team, who's a character, to say the least. The Cannings, you'd be a similar age to Ollie, would you?
Ollie's a few years older than me. Ollie'd be about 38 or 39 now. Jeez, he could be even 40. Damien would be a year older than me. He's the same age as me, born in the same year. I'm at the end of the year compared to Damien, but he was a year older than me in school. And obviously Keith Hayes was there, Joe was a couple of years underneath. There was quite a lot of talent came out of that small little village that we're from just outside of Portumna, and there's always a hurling stronghold around there, and it was always, I suppose, nice to be up there and in the school and playing with all those and testing yourself against all those, because there was a lot of those lads had gone through the county underage systems, and obviously Niall Hayes, Damien's older brother, all the Cannons all went through it. So yeah, it was a fairly tasty and lively school to be involved in, considering as a two-teacher national school. We were hurled with people way older than us, and we got involved in divement with people way older than us. So it was a good learning curve, both sports-wise and in life in general. So
did a young Joe start mixing with an older John Muldoon? Was he kind of there getting involved in the fringes of some of those matches?
Joe, obviously I know Joe very well, and from an early age you could tell Joe had something special. I think when you have a wide age gap, and some of the Cannons mightn't like me hearing saying that, but Shamey in particular, but when you've got a wide age gap and Joe's 5 or 6 or 7 years of age and his brothers are playing senior hurling with Portumna and you're in the middle of the summer, Joe was brought along to every training, every match and everything, and he'd be out the other end of the field pucking balls over the bar from 50, 60 metres at 5, 6, 7 years of age. And that's That's no exaggerating. He was pucking the ball over the bar at 5, 6, 7 years of age from 30, 40, 50, 60 metres out and able to take 65s.
That's unbelievable.
There isn't a word of a lie in that, I promise you. From an early age, everyone could see that Joe had it. And
what age might a normal person be able to start doing that?
I don't think I could hit the ball over the bar as a minor from that far, but obviously he might have been using a smaller ball, but he was still pretty good. And even as a kid, he would stand in goals if they were missing one or two for the seniors. At 8, 9, 10 years of age, Joe would stand in goals for the seniors and puck balls out to the halfway line, no problem. And he was doing that from a very, very young age. And I think once you're bred into that, things are going to come quite easy to you. And you see the ease that he has of chucking a ball over the bar from 70, 80, 90 yards out. Yeah. And obviously we saw that the last day in Crow Park as well. One of those flicks of the wrist that he gave for one of those points, it looked effortless from all of 100 plus yards.
That's amazing. That's an amazing image, even just to think of, like, I guess he's a prodigy effectively doing that. And it is just technique. I mean, that's what it boils down to, timing and technique, to be able to do that at his size.
And yeah, absolutely. And time out there, and that's again what I alluded to earlier, being outside all the time and being on a pitch and hitting balls over the bar and hitting the shed, I think, from their back garden. They used to have a shed they used to try and hit the ball at from a long time. And it takes a lot of time to master skills, and he certainly did it as a kid, I think.
When you first encountered rugby in your mid-teens, and I saw a quote from you before where you were saying, you know, at 16 years of age, when Bernard Jackman and a few other Connacht players came out to Portumna and took a training session, that's when I realised I could play professional rugby. And I know maybe you'd kind of encountered the sport a few years before that. Did you instantly fall in love with it to the point where it was very genuine competition for hurling? Or was it just a case that this was a way to have a professional sporting lifestyle?
Yeah, it's rugby came into my life maybe a year or two before that. It was actually, ironically, it was the Lions of 97 that it started to really kind of take a hold. I started playing a few months previous to the Lions. Then the Lions, obviously, 97 went to South Africa and the victorious team. And I watched it that summer, and I suppose that kind of sparked an ignition in me and a vigoration towards rugby, which I probably didn't have up to that point. I used to watch the Six Nations and used to watch when I was on TV. I knew the rules, but it never really grasped me until that point. And I dabbled a little bit in it prior to that. My brother was playing and I used to go out to the garden and he used to hit me, and I wasn't particularly enjoyed being tackled by my brother trying to upskill himself. But I think from when that Lions took on, that really kind of got the creative juices going. And then I suppose I didn't really see it until Birch and Michael Webster and Mel Dean, actually, ironically, because I ended up playing with two of them. That makes me sound very old. But they came to the school with our coach, Dahi Frawley, who Had connections, obviously, in Connacht, was a Connacht president a few years after that. They came to the school, took a training session, and I suppose afterwards you sit and you chat to you chat to them. It was kind of an open forum, and one of the lads just said, "Oh, what do you do?" And I think Birch said, "Oh, we're professional rugby players. We're like soccer players." And at that point, I never really thought about it.
Right.
It was on the back of obviously the Lions that year, and a few weeks or a few months later, we went to see. I went to see Connacht playing Northampton, or they beat Northampton in the sports ground. I actually mitched school off that day, which I got in trouble for as well. But we mitched school to go see the match, and they beat Northampton. And suddenly, I suppose those heroes that I had been looking at, Matt Dawson, Tim Rodber, a few of those lads that had been on the Lions, were suddenly standing in the sports ground. There was literally about 200 people at the game. It was on a Wednesday afternoon. I should have been in school. I had a jacket over my school uniform, and that's when it kind of hit me that, geez, if you were good at this or enjoyed this, you could be a professional. And obviously every kid dreams of being a professional. I was absolutely no good at soccer, but I always dreamed as a kid, when I was chucking balls in the goals, that you could become a professional soccer player. But I was absolutely no good at it. But you always dream that you can do something, you can do something as a professional. And suddenly that became a realization. Geez, if things went right, you could be a professional rugby player. And I suppose I looked at it a bit differently from that point of view.
Right.
And then obviously it takes a long time to get from a 7 or a 16 year old at that point to making a professional rugby player. A lot of things have to go right for you.
Things happen pretty quickly. Like you get a full-time contract around 19 years of age. So it's kind of amazing in that respect. And, you know, 300 appearances later, like for a long time in Irish rugby, it was an amazing landmark for a player to get past 200. And for you to go 300, the first Irish player to ever do it over 15 years, really is an amazing achievement. It's funny, you're on tonight. We had Peter Stringer on last night, and 39 years old, and he was just talking to us about what an obsessive he's become over his body, over his sleep. He didn't buy a toaster when he moved to Bath because he was enjoying toast and Nutella too much, and like exercises every day. He was in Mexico on holidays trying to relax, and it was too hot to exercise, so he found an underground car park near the hotel and did shuttle sprints and a skipping rope there, just by his own admission, kind of insane, but, you know, self-aware. So it's maybe less crazy, and it's not the worst vice. Obviously, teetotal all his life as well.
Yeah.
I guess it does. Where are you on that spectrum of obsessiveness and thinking about your longevity, John, at 34 years of age now?
Yeah, I think probably the word that probably comes to mind that people who know me would be stubbornness. I think I say that, and obviously I have to explain that as well. I think people that know me will know I'm quite competitive. Even if we're messing in the gym and we start playing a game, I want to win. I get quite angry and ratty with people if I don't win. I get very competitive, even doing fitness games when we're doing games. And it's stubbornness out of myself to want to play on, and to want to prove people wrong that I shouldn't be playing, or I could be playing, or you shouldn't be playing at your age, or whatever the case may be. And I suppose there's that built-in stubbornness that I've had all my life, and that competitiveness that I've had. Also, I suppose the older you get, the more you know you have to break down more barriers, and more, I suppose, you have to be more self-aware, because there's no point me standing at the front or trying to lead from the front and then not being able to do what I'm talking about. So there's a bit of onus on yourself to be talking about something, and to be doing, and to actually go out and do it is another thing. So I'm very conscious of that, and a bit like Strings, I'd be very conscious. Obviously, unlike Strings, I do like to have a drink, and it certainly does affect me at this stage of my career, and it does affect me. It probably didn't affect me as much when you're younger, but it certainly does. But
how do you feel?
It just takes you longer to recover.
Yeah.
Takes you longer to come back. But I think everything in moderation is good.
Because it's interesting, actually. I'll just dive in there for a sec. So you've Stringer on, who's one extreme, and seeing as we're talking Joe Cannon, he jumps to mind because he did that interview the other week in the Irish Independent. Really good interview. If you didn't see it, and
I saw Joe. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, he drew the parallel between what he sees the rugby players when he was down in Limerick. He'd see the lads going for a drink after a Pro 12 game. 2, 3, 4 drinks after a game, no problem. Maybe a few more, but you do it fairly regularly. Whereas the GAA lads, there's a kind of cultural obsession with drinking bans. And then when they get their 2 or 3 nights where they're allowed drink, it's Armageddon for their liver. They just go absolutely nuts and completely binge drink. Is that right what he says about the rugby situation? It's kind of a few drinks after every game, maybe?
Not every game, obviously. If you want to play to a certain level and you want to perform at a certain level. Look, I think the reality is everybody's different. However amount of runs it takes me to get fit, and it's like saying how many drinks is Peter Stringer going to be able to have, how many drinks is John Muldoon going to have, how many drinks is Joe Cannon going to have. Everybody differs in terms of how much work they need to get fit, how much drink they can take, etc. So everybody's different. I know personally I can't go out every week and drink, but at the same time I need to let my hair down every now and again, and I need to go out and have a few drinks and be sociable with my friends, be sociable with the lads. I do think what's, I suppose, expected from the GAA at the moment is utter madness.
Mm. I think most people think that at this stage.
Yeah, amateur players who go out there, who are doing the best for themselves, for their families, for their parishes, for their counties, who don't get paid anything, who are probably leaving work most days early, getting off work, probably losing money from doing it, and then they're not allowed to go out at the weekend and socialise after a big game. To me, it's ludicrous. Mm. I think one of the things we all know is when you're involved in a team environment, it's how good you get on with the team. And let's be honest here, there's many ways to do it, but going out, sitting down, having a chat with over a pint is probably one of the best ways. And we all know it does break down barriers. Needless to say, as I said from the very beginning, everybody's different. So what works for me might not work for somebody else. And I know personally, as I get older and as I suppose the rigors of rugby gets more, those nights are less and less and less. Mm. But at the same time, you still have to have that outlet that you can go and have a drink and enjoy each other's company and enjoy each other's companionship, because there's lots of tough nights, and sometimes you come up with some good ideas and some stupid ideas when you've had a drink on, and you do get a bit closer to your friends and the people that you spend most of the time with. And we spend a lot of time together as professional rugby players, and same with the hurlers, and same with the footballers. So look, I think Joe hit the nail on the head for me. What's been asked of certain players and been asked of amateur sports people at the moment is a bit excessive. And look, at the end of the day, we all look after ourselves. We all know what's best for us. Maybe sometimes when you're a little bit younger, you mightn't get the balance right. But as you get a little bit older, you get more wise, and you know, unfortunately, it's like life. You know from your mistakes what works and what doesn't. But it's certainly, I think, the rigors of what they're up to, and I suppose the peer pressure from society is certainly a tough one.
Mm. I dare say you were of a vintage where for much of your career there was no such thing as yoga lattes and stretching, and also you probably ate pasta by the bucket load. Like, that was very much in vogue. You can't have enough pasta. Like, has that all kind of changed now? Is your diet completely different now?
Surprisingly, I was never a pasta or a rice fan. So my diet now in... looking back over the last 10 years hasn't changed a huge amount.
Right.
It's plenty of food, plenty of the food that you would find on a normal dinner, on normal, need I say, country households.
It's a bit of meat, few spuds, and a few veg.
Absolutely, and lots of it. And stay away from anything that's got packaging around it, and go to the green aisle. Or go to the green aisle section with nothing around it, wash it, throw it in the under a bit of water or on top of a bit of water, and off you go. And don't leave it like my mum does for about an hour on there, and that it's nearly dripping down through the drain.
Look, there's a generation of Irish women who had to make sure it was cooked.
That's and the meat is definitely dead as well. Don't do it that way either. But I think obviously there's a lot of science behind everything now, and I was never a pasta person or never a rice person. It was never my favourite, but I think a lot of the things haven't changed. For us, again, compared to other sports, I was on a show recently with Ruby Walsh, and he nearly got sick when I told him how much I was eating a day. I think it was 4,000 or 5,000 calories a day, and he said he'd be lucky to eat that in a week. And I am conscious of the fact that we are quite lucky. We burn a lot of calories, and we do have to eat a lot to try and stay on top of things. And weight is a huge thing for some lads in our sport. They have to keep on the weight, and it means they have to overeat. And we call it eating dirty sometimes. And myself included, over the years, if I eat healthy all the time, I lose weight. And there's a lot of people out there listening going, oh, Jesus. So if I eat all the good things that I suppose are supposed to be it, I will actually lose weight. That's how my body works. So I sometimes can use that frame. I can eat dirty sometimes. So I'm allowed to have a little bit of extra fat in my diet, which comes from all the nice foods that we're not really supposed to have, which is a great benefit to us, especially when you like food.
What's been the imprint of Pat Lam, John? But like, so on the pitch, I think we've seen, and I'm going to ask you about Killian Keane, and he seems keen to play attacking rugby.
Killian retired a long time ago.
Killian, yeah, that's Freudian, yeah. I'm looking at him here sitting beside you in the press conference yesterday. The Mad Professor, I didn't realise was his nickname.
That was news to me as well.
So, but we'll get on to Kieran. Pat Lam, both on and off the pitch, like anytime he's on the show, we kind of come away going, God, what a man of real presence, and everything from the handshake, and you could kind of scoff at in a way, you know, it's kind of an Irish cynical thing, but actually over time I think everybody saw the value in it, and I know Leinster shake hands, and the importance of connecting with your fellow teammate was certainly huge for him. We saw what he did on the pitch. Culturally, you've been there a long time, and I suppose you would have seen pre-Lam what he brought to it and the legacy.
Yeah, I think in a way it takes a foreigner to come in to, I suppose, appreciate what you have, where you live, the circumstances of, I suppose, where our pitch is, the environment that we live in, situational things that maybe are there every day that you take for granted. The easy thing is, and I was speaking to somebody recently about this, the easy thing is to walk into your office or your I suppose your place of work, and to go to the people that you, I suppose, get on with best, or your friends in that environment, and to go over to them and say hello to them and chat to them first thing in the morning. The handshake one is one where you have to put yourself out and go to 34, 35, 40 individuals and stand there for 2 seconds, or stand there for 2 minutes, or stand there for 10 minutes chatting to someone going, hey, how are things? Good morning, and just go, how are you? And it seems very kind of, I suppose, circumspect and a bit kind of, oh yeah, whatever. But at the end of the day, you put yourself out there to talk to people maybe who aren't on your radar for the rest of that day, but you've made an effort to go and speak to them.
What was the effect of that, John?
It definitely brought us closer together. Nearly took a foreigner to come in to show us that, yes, don't take each other for granted, don't take the place you live in for granted, don't take the supporters for granted. And at the time, we were trying to build a connection with our community, and more so a connection outside of Galway. We'd built quite a good fan base in Galway City and the surrounding areas, but we had to go out and try and entice more people from around the province to come to the games. And we went out to the community and we saw huge benefits from it. We'd go up to Belmullet, we went to Leitrim, we went to Athlone, Ballina, and suddenly 2-3 weeks later you're down at a game and you're looking at those faces looking in at you as you're walking off the pitch, and it made a huge difference. I think the sports ground, we all know, is unique. It is what it is. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but suddenly there's a hostile environment for other teams to come there, not just the weather. The supporters are on top of us, and it's G'ing us up. It's helping us. And Pat obviously was a massive driving force in that, and the culture and everything that went with it, suddenly everything took a step up. Pat obviously brought a clear plan of what he wanted to do off the pitch, a clear plan how you fit it into it on the pitch, and then he just filled in the gaps with one or two players like Bundy and Tom McCartney, etc. And suddenly the whole thing took off.
And there were amazing moments there. Like, I think everybody vividly remembers the cries of kick it, kick it, kick it coming in from the stands. There was a Leinster game, certainly, where you were under the caution, your own 22, and refused to kick the ball. And Pat Lam was saying things like, well, I encourage the players not necessarily to just run into the opposition players, maybe try and run around them where possible. And this was interestingly as well at a time where it seemed like the national team was playing pretty direct rugby. And it was, you know, Connacht and Pat Lam and all you guys were almost an example of potentially what could be done even in this kind of weather. Your skill set was often mentioned. You know, look at the way John Muldoon has improved his skill set, and his handling was something which was said on this show by various pundits. Is that true? Did you massively or substantially improve your skill set and your hands?
I definitely improved them. I think the other side of it was the skills were always there. It was just the game plan that we traditionally play in Ireland and that we've used in Ireland didn't, I suppose, the question I used to get sometimes, and I'll go back to that in a second. The question I used to get sometimes is, why are you standing on the wing? Why are you out in the centres? Whereas if you had been out there maybe 3-4 years previously to Pat coming, people would have considered you lazy or glory hunting. Why is that wing forward standing on the wing? Why is that number 8 standing all the way out there? But I suppose Pat brought a different style. And I suppose one of the mantras that we had was, you share the workload. So it wasn't a case where forwards come around the corner and carry the ball 4 times and then you throw it out to the back line. You could see Bundy carrying 1 minute, a forward carrying another minute, then the ball could be spread to the wing and Ulton could be standing on the wing, for example. So it was share the workload, work in the space, don't have people, I suppose, changing positions to carry ball. If you're closest to the ball, let you carry it. If you're out in the wing, stay out in the wing and carry it. And
right.
I suppose to do all those things, we needed to upskill players. And certainly a lot of it was the mindset change, the mindset that you're going to be on the wing and you're going to need to be able to pass left to right 10 metres or 15 metres. And we all could do it, but it's to do it under pressure, under fatigue in the 78th minute of the game. And I suppose the big thing, going back to the original question in the Leinster game, I suppose our competition and European competition had got into a scenario where there was always 3-4 players in the backfield. If there's 3-4 players in the backfield and one man is on the ground being tackled or making a tackle, it means you're left with 9-10 players in the front line. So our objective was hold on to the ball, don't kick it into the backfield because they've 3-4 players back there.
Yeah.
Let's try and attack and move them from space to space, and especially some of the bigger teams, let's move them and try and be able to hit on the right-hand side, hit in the middle, and then try and get them on the left-hand side or vice versa. If they fold around the corner, go back again to the right-hand side. So, unfortunately, it's like everything. You go out, you start something new, everyone else starts copying you, everyone else, I suppose, analyses everything. Mm. And then last year, what was happening was, which is probably our own fault, was we should have started kicking more because we were coming up against teams that had 13, 14 men in the front line and 2 men in the backfield.
Yeah.
And that's where you need to adapt. And that's
play
probably something. Yeah, exactly. And while the first year or two, we moved the ball around and we saw, oh, there's people in the backfield, let's run it. We needed to adapt again last year and start to kick it more.
Mm.
But I think we probably were liking ourselves running the ball too much and didn't want to defend too often. So
yeah.
We'd kind of set ourselves up to want to attack. So, look, it's about getting that balance right. And unfortunately, last year, we just didn't do it right. There was times we should have kicked when we didn't and vice versa. And we were running into brick walls at times. And I suppose we were a little bit too egotistical, thinking we could run the ball the length of the field against 14 players in the front line. So,
yeah.
And we got it wrong, unfortunately.
Very interesting, though, to hear the comparison between the few years. So Kieran Keane has come in. He was in charge of the Chiefs' attack up until this season. And if you know anyone who watched any Super Rugby, that was a fairly thrilling style of play. And he was in his press conference yesterday. I know you were there, but for the listeners, he was asked about the fact that he's called the Mad Professor back at home. And he said, the unfortunate thing for myself is that I dream about rugby. I dream about it when I'm awake and when I'm asleep. I have that mantle, as you just described, the Mad Professor, from a number of colleagues, because I was always trying to think ahead, innovate, if you like. Innovation has always been part of my creed about playing the game. And sometimes when you're listening to me, you can get lost because I'm away with the fairies. So already I'm in love with Kieran Keane, and this guy sounds like, just what Connacht need. The word innovation, really important. Touch of a sense of humour about him as well. How have you found him? What kind of guy is he?
Yeah, he's an interesting character with a very witty sense of humour and a man who's able to I won't call him a Jekyll and Hyde, but he's able to go from serious to funny back to serious within a couple of short sentences. And he's certainly a very, very interesting character. He's someone who obviously, going back a few months, not an awful lot of people, he wouldn't have been a household name.
No.
But when you look down through his CV and you look at the teams he's worked with, the coaches that he's worked with, he's got a spectacular CV. He's worked with some of the top players and the top coaches in New Zealand. Also, I suppose from our point of view, he also came from a place, Tasman, which has very, very strong similarities to Connacht, a team that nearly got disbanded, had a very, very low budget in comparison to other teams in the, it used to be the Air New Zealand Cup. I think it's called the Mitra 10 now. He won a championship with them on a low budget with players who maybe had got let go out of other teams who probably weren't deemed to be making it in quick enough or deemed not to be good enough, brought in all these players, upskilled them and managed to win a championship with them. And a lot of those players are now the top players who are playing for New Zealand and playing in the Super 15 with the Hurricanes, the Highlanders, the Chiefs and the Crusaders. So he got these kids who maybe didn't come through the normal pathway who have now made it into New Zealand rugby. And in a lot of ways, there's a lot of similarities there to what Pat tried to do in the past and what Connacht have tried to do over the last 10 years. So he knows what it's like to, I suppose, to deal with players who potentially, for the want of a better word, have missed the boat or haven't come through the normal pathway. So and he also says he likes a team that's full of workers and comes from a harsh environment. I've never been to Tasman, but apparently it's not too dissimilar to the west of Ireland. So he's a lot of similarities. He's been around the game a long time. He's a school teacher like Pat. I think he said...
Are there any coaches in this country who aren't school teachers? My God.
Not too many. It just seems to be a very kind of, I don't know... I suppose teaching environment and very kind of that sense of, I don't know how you say it, it's that kind of mentality that teachers progress well or do something.
Yeah,
but,
it's amazing.
He's certainly an interesting character. He's 62, but if you hung around with him for a few minutes, he doesn't come across as a man who's 62 years of age. He's very very upbeat and he can lift you down pretty quickly as well. We've seen. He likes to use all the management tools that are out there. So no, it's been good. He's here just over a week now. Nearly 2 weeks, and yeah, we've been enjoying it. And we did a little climb to Crowpatrick at the weekend as a kind of finish up to the end of the season. And Kieran walked it with us and did very well to get up there.
Okay,
it's not easy.
No, that sounds great. Really exciting times ahead. So. Listen, the best of luck. I'm not going to ask you, by the way, have you any plans for retirement or beyond rugby? Because I think athletes your age should be allowed to do these interviews once in a while and not get asked that question. But I did see on your 300th game, Connacht released a video. All the other players were talking about really the contribution you'd made. Just to make you blush in case listeners hadn't heard it, here's what, I guess they'll recognise some of the voices, Pat Lambs in here and Eric Elwood and a number of the players summing up your contribution or summing you up in a word or two.
He's never let the team down.
That's his main thing, delivery.
Loyal.
Committed, accountable, respected, tough teammate.
Trustworthy, honest, and he's tough and resilient.
For me, Mull is a mentor and a leader.
The greatest leader that I've had the pleasure of playing rugby with.
Incredibly dedicated. He gets everyone into the right frame of mind.
He's always honest in what he says.
His work rate, his desire, his durability.
You could describe him as Mr. Connacht.
A good friend who has Connacht embedded in his DNA.
100% commitment.
I'm very proud of where I'm from. I'm very proud of the people that I represent. I know every time I go out onto the pitch why I'm doing it. Any young kid who is thinking about being a rugby player, take the opportunity if you get it, because there's no better job. I wouldn't give this job up for anything, and if the body and the mind wants to keep going, why not? Because I certainly love what I do.
That's not bad. If you're waking up not feeling at it in the morning, stick that on and get yourself going again.
Yeah, look, some very kind words from a lot of very good players that I played against, a lot of good friends there. Look, I've said it a couple of times. I'm obviously very honoured to play for Connacht, and I'm very honoured to do something that I know people, a lot of people would love and bite your hand off to do it. And I'm privileged that I've got a good innings at it and a good run at it, and it's something that I enjoy doing. I get up every morning and I love it. But at the same time, look, Connacht Rugby's given me an awful lot as well. I'm very, very conscious of that, and I'd hope that Connacht will be a force for many years to come, and I hope there's a lot of young fellas and young girls in around the Connacht area that want to play and represent Connacht and want to represent Ireland, and that's the main thing. And there's a lot of familiar voices there for me that are very, very good friends, and I've had a bloody hell of a good time playing with them in good days and bad, and a lot of fond memories. So yeah, it's been good. But look, we've another journey to go on this year, and with a new coach, and I'm enjoying the new season, and I'm enjoying working with Kieran and a few of the new coaches that are in as well. So yeah, I think it's very positive. Connacht Rugby's going in a good direction, and I'm hoping that I'll be there along for the ride again for a little while longer.
Off the ball.
Get all the best bits at newstalk.com/offtheball.
Newstalk 106 to 108.